From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. Barack Obama and Mitt Romney may not want to talk much about poverty, but Cornel West and Tavis Smiley do. The public intellectual and the busy broadcaster have been out on the road saying, pay attention to the poor. Now they've got a manifesto for addressing a problem they say may be lapping at your door. This hour, On Point, Cornel West and Tavis Smiley on American poverty. You can join the conversation. Do you see it? Do you live it? The poverty that has spread? Why aren't we talking more about it? Are we in denial? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. And you can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. We will go in a moment to Weston, Smiley, and poverty, but first, from the big money side, a high-profile CEO got his $15 million pay package rejected by shareholders this week. In big money country, that was an earthquake. Doesn't happen, but it did. Joining me now from New York is Bloomberg News finance reporter Brad Cowan. Brad, welcome to On Point.
Thank you.
Who got his pay package jammed back down the board's throat?
Well, Vikram Pandit was the CEO of Citigroup, and it turns out that shareholders were none too pleased with the amount that he was given for 2011, which is $15 million, according to the official company filing. But if you go through the footnotes of the reports and add up some other incentives that he could get if the bank performs a certain way, he could get as much as $55 million.
So what happened exactly? How did this get, at least by the shareholders so far, rejected?
Well, it actually was quite a surprise, and partly it was because shareholders usually go along with what the boards recommend. Even Citigroup, which got the $45 billion bailout from taxpayers back in 2008, had still essentially kept its board in place. They made some changes to their board, but there were never any board members who were voted off. And there were really never a shareholder revolt in the few years that came after the financial crisis. So here you have, you know, shareholders sort of finding a footing and saying, you know what, we're not going to take it anymore.
How rare is this in the world of high finance and CEO pay?
It's very rare. There was an analysis that we cited in our story of 3,000 companies in the 3,000 largest companies last year. Only 40 actually had any sort of pushback on pay from the shareholders. And among bigger banks, it's even more rare. There was only one bank that previously had its pay proposal rejected. And it should be noted that this is an advisory vote. It's mm-hmm. non-binding. So, for example, the one other bank, which was KeyCorp, which is an Ohio bank, the CEO was given $5 million for 2010. The shareholders voted that down, and the board came back and changed it to $4.5 million.
The shareholder vote, this is mandated by the Dodd-Frank financial overhaul law, non-binding. Is the board going to give him his $15 million plus maybe anyway?
Well, the chairman, Richard Parsons, who obviously was very involved in designing this compensation packages, was asked about this at the company's annual meeting shortly after the vote was announced. And he said that the problem was just in how the compensation for the CEO was communicated to shareholders. And he said it needs to be tied more towards the formulas. And he really made no commitment on whether they would actually reduce the absolute level of pay or even whether he disagreed with the absolute level of pay or thought that they would take that into consideration.
We just have a communication problem here, I guess. Now, Vikram Pandit did work for a dollar a year for the last year or two. So apparently the board felt, oh, things are a little better. Time for him to have $15 million maybe plus. But Citigroup's shares were way down last year.
That is probably what was a big factor in the shareholders' vote. I mean, you know, in a lot of capitalism and here in America, you know, culturally, we don't necessarily begrudge people the money that they make. As long as the performance is there or as long as they're perceived to actually bringing making money for the the people that employ them. And in this case, the shareholders are saying, look, I see what you're getting, but I haven't been getting what I think I want to get.
So forget about it. And that was an earthquake in that world. Hey, what about, we're talking about poverty this hour. What about at the tip top, the top 100 CEOs or so? What's happening with their pay in this recession in the last year, Brad?
I don't have the details on the top 100 CEOs. What we do have is I've looked at the bank CEOs, and that was another departure for Citigroup. Is, as you say, he went from a dollar to 15 or 55, depending on how you count it. But Wall Street really did not have a great year last year. The revenue was down and the profits were down. And so most of the CEOs actually did take, pay cuts. So that was the trend on Wall Street last year. I mean, they still make, a lot of money. Jamie Dimon, the CEO of J.P. Morgan, made $23 million. And we did a story last week. And looking at the what he makes relative to the average investment banker and trader, and this is not even just the rank and file employee. This is, these are pretty high paid employees, and the ratio of his pay to these rank and file investment bankers and traders was 67 times, and that was up from 62 times. And people look at this as kind of a barometer for, generally whether pay is in line or out of line. And it's interesting. I mean, people just have a view that the CEO really does actually make a lot more than the rank and file workers. And we quoted a pay consultant who say that, 30 to 50 times is probably too low for the industry. And so, back in 2006 and 2007, before the crisis, the ratio topped 100 to 1. So this is something that people look at.
67 times the wage of those in banking and finance, never mind Americans at large. I'm looking here, average American salary, $45,000. Median chief executive in the top paid 100, $14.4 million. Brad Cowan with Bloomberg News in New York. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Let's look at American poverty. Joining me now from New York, Tavis Smiley and Cornel West. Tavis is all over public broadcasting on PBS with his late night show and on radio with the Tavis Smiley Show and Smiley and West with Cornel West. His new book with Professor West is The Rich and the Rest of Us, A Poverty Manifesto. Tavis Smiley, welcome. Great to have you.
Tom, delighted to be on the program with you. Thanks for the opportunity, sir.
And with Tavis in New York, Cornel West, one of the country's most prominent and outspoken public intellectuals. He of Harvard and Princeton, and now on his way back to Union Theological Seminary in New York City, back to the root, professor of African-American studies at Princeton, author of Race Matters, Democracy Matters, and Brother West, Living Out Loud, and now with Tavis Smiley, The Rich and the Rest of Us. Cornel West, welcome back to On Point.
Thank you, my dear brother.
It's good to have you. Tavis, what's going on?
Poverty, too much of it. One out of two Americans is now living in or near poverty. You take the perennially poor, the new poor, we refer to the new poor in this text, Tom, as the former middle class. And then you add to that the near poor, folk who are paycheck away. You're talking 150 million Americans, which means half of the nation is wrestling with poverty. What's going on is too much poverty and not enough conversation, much less a plan to reduce it and eradicate it coming out of Washington.
One out of two Americans. That's kind of a head snapper, and not everybody picks up that number. I mean, I'm reading Jesse Jackson here saying one in three Americans is in poverty or classified as low income. One out of two, half of America is in poverty?
Well, it's unbelievable.
Yeah.
You look at the Census Bureau data, and Byron Pitts on December the 15th, 2011, right on the CBS show, said one out of two, poor, near poverty, which includes, of course, low income, and barely making it, on the edge. It is incredible. It's unbelievable, but it is true. It's so sad.
What does that mean when you say, how high up do you go? Do you get right up to the median income there? Or I'm trying to understand exactly where the top end of this, extreme poverty we understand, poverty we understand, near poverty we understand, but I'm not sure where your cutoff line is, Tavis, for those you're talking about in The Rich and the Rest of Us.
Well, first of all, there is, of course, a federal government standard. It's about $22,000, just over $22,000.
That's the poverty line.
which is the poverty line.
So, yeah.
Family of four. Now, first of all, let's just stop. We can't say that and move past that so quickly. Mm-hmm. How in the world does a family of four, Tom, live off of $22,000 a year? So first of all, even the arbitrary, I shouldn't say arbitrary, it's not arbitrary, but the mm-hmm. formula that they use mm-hmm. to determine the poverty line is out of whack in the first place. So one, you have people who are at the poverty line of 22 who really are in poverty to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
That's number one. So let's talk about lines here of demarcation. But mm-hmm. then when we say the near poor, to answer your question more expressly,
yes.
we're talking about Americans who are just a paycheck or so away from being poor. And when we talk about the new poor, we're talking about Americans, many in the middle class, who lost their jobs, lost their homes, had their 401k raped and pillaged, lost all their savings, and now they're just trying to find work after a year or two or three of being unemployed and just trying to hold on to their dignity. You put all three of those groups together, again, the persistent poor, the new poor, the near poor, you're talking half the country.
Why does it, Cornel West, why does it take you and Tavis to rattle the bars about this? Why aren't our leaders talking about this? You say they're not, even President Obama, barely.
Well, one, of course, Tavis and I are not by any stretch of one's imagination the only ones or even the main ones. People like Marion Wright Edelman, great prophetic figures dealing with poverty, building on the legacy of Martin King and Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel and Dorothy Day and others. The Catholic bishops, strong on issues of poverty. I might disagree with them when it comes to issues of gender and women. Strong on poverty.
Cornel West, hold it right there if you'd be good enough. It's great to have you there. And Tavis Smiley, we've got to take a short break right here. The new book is The Rich and the Rest of Us, A Poverty Manifesto. Listeners, you can join us. Is this you, poor and more poor? Were you middle class before and feeling poor now? Are we in denial about poverty in this country? 800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about American poverty. With Cornel West and Tavis Smiley, they say it's time to do something about the rising tide of poor. Their new book just out is The Rich and the Rest of Us, A Poverty Manifesto. You can join the conversation this hour. Is this you, poor and more poor, maybe recently poor? Are we in denial about poverty in this country and just how widespread it has become? When was the last time you heard a politician talk not just about the middle class, but about the poor, about poverty? 800-423-8255 is our number. 800-423-TALK. Tavis Smiley and Cornel West join us from New York City. And they are raising a big alarm here. Tavis, put this in some kind of historical perspective for us. I mean, in terms of poverty ratios and near poverty ratios in this country, where are we? Has it ever been thus or something new going on?
First of all, I love the question you ask. When's the last time you heard a politician talk about the poor and not just the middle class? And that's what we're up against with Mr. Obama and the presumptive Republican nominee, Mr. Romney, wanting to speak again to the angst of the middle class. Mm-hmm. If we're right, and I think we are, Tom, that the new poor are the former middle class, you can't just talk then this time around about the angst of the middle class, given that they are disappearing in this country. To your question now, though, about how we arrived at this place, the first chapter of the book is called A Portrait of Poverty, and we take painstaking time to lay out for the reader in a narrative that's easily read and easily understood and digestible how we arrived at this place. The short answer is that we have not had a sustained conversation from the top down, that is to say the White House down, in this country about poverty and about poor people since the Lyndon Johnson administration and its war on poverty. And obviously since that time, we've had Democrat and Republican presidents who've occupied the White House who have not made poverty a priority in this country. So two things. Number one, we argue in the text that there appears to be, at least to our thinking, Tom, a bipartisan consensus in Washington. Bipartisan consensus that the poor don't matter, that poverty just doesn't matter, number one. And number two, we argue that while people tend to think of poverty as color-coded, black or brown, that is, Americans of all races, colors, and creeds are falling into poverty. And at this point, here's the point, right now, poverty then threatens our very democracy. We argue in the text that poverty, Tom, is a matter of national security.
Cornel West, how can it be, if we go with your 1 in 2 number or take Jesse Jackson's 1 in 3 number, and many others use that as well, Jason DePaul of the New York Times, if it's that high, poor or near poor, that the subject has kind of fallen off the national agenda? How can it be when it's that big and that pressing, as you describe it, that it's not more on our minds or in our conversation in a democracy?
I think the two pillars that constitute the grounds for our public conversation, which is to say, on the one hand, corporate media, thank God for you, Brother Tom, willing to engage this issue. But corporate media tends to hold it at arm's length. On the other hand, politicians tend to hold it at arm's length. We know the latter, the political system itself, very much broken down, dominated by big money, dominated by oligarchs and plutocrats who tend to be relatively indifferent toward the poor. When they think about the poor, it is a philanthropic gesture. It's not a commitment to justice, a just arrangement of our society. And corporate media reflects that truncated discourse of the politicians. So even when they talk about the middle class, that's almost a concession, because both parties are so tied to oligarchic and plutocratic rule. The Republicans, a deeply conservative version, and the Democrats, a neoliberal version, neither one of them concerned about poverty, poor people, and one can even argue working people.
And which is kind of amazing when it makes up, by your calculation and others, such a big portion of the country. I mean, this is
Absolutely.
America, or a big chunk of it. But let's listen. Let's listen to the political discourse. Here's the president, Obama. This was September, Cincinnati, Ohio. We could have plucked this from many spots during his years in the White House. But here's the president saying he is a warrior for the middle class.
You know what? I'm a warrior for the middle class. I'm happy to fight for the middle class. I'm happy to fight for working people. Because the only warfare I've seen is the battle against the middle class.
Cornel West, I almost hear in that, I'm happy to fight for working people. I almost hear a get out of my way, poor people. I'm not here to talk about almost an active avoidance of poverty right there.
Well, we're not even talking about the kind of denial and avoidance you're talking about, but it just isn't true in terms of being a warrior for the working class. I mean, the labor movement has called for support of the Employee Free Choice Act. That was a precondition of them supporting him. He still hasn't supported that. He's a warrior for investment bankers. He's been a warrior for the well-to-do, and he embraces working and poor people. There are elements in his historic health care bill that are positive in that regard. Mm-hmm. But when you actually look at the tilt of the administration, it's not working people are poor. It's still very much Wall Street and bankers and the well-to-do. The moneyed classes who make their own very soft criticisms, but his policies have tilted in that direction. And when he says, I'm a warrior for middle class, oh, that's the populist rhetoric during the campaign, not the policies on the ground. And Tavis and I, of course, want all of us, not just him. We want all of us to be warriors for justice.
Boy, I remember
when warriors for justice, you include poor people yeah. and put working and poor people at the center.
I remember when you were here with me on the air, this is 4 years ago now, very gung-ho for Barack Obama. But hold the thought right there for a minute, Cornell and Tavis. Here on the other side of the ledger, here's Mitt Romney. This was CNN in February. Everybody's heard this, but let's just listen again.
I'm not concerned about the very poor. We have a safety net there. If it needs a repair, I'll fix it. I'm not concerned about the very rich. They're doing just fine. I mean, you can choose where to focus. You can focus on the rich. That's not my focus. You can focus on the very poor. That's not my focus. My focus is on middle-income Americans.
Tavis Smiley, what do you hear on the Mitt Romney side of the ledger there? I am not concerned about the very poor. He came back and said, that's not exactly what I meant, but there it was.
Well, he was being honest. The Bible says that I read, out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaketh. If it's in your heart, it's going to come out. And I think it came out in a moment. And Mitt does that a lot on the campaign trail. Kind of puts his silver foot in his mouth, to quote Ann Richards out of Texas. But the reality is he's right about two things. He is not concerned about the very rich. They are doing just fine. He is absolutely right about that. He's right about the fact that he's not focusing and concerned about the very poor, and that's the problem. The reality is, when he talks about a social safety net, we don't have anymore a social safety net. And the net that we once had has got gaping holes in it, and poor people are falling through those holes. And here's the thing, Tom. The group of Americans, and this is hard for me even to get out because it makes such a damning statement about our country. The group of Americans falling fastest into poverty right now are women and children. Something is wrong with the nation that allows its women and children, oftentimes it's weak and vulnerable, to fall into poverty faster than anybody else. But hear this statement. Mm. We talk about this in the text. The younger you are in America, Tom, the more likely you are to be poor. I mean, just say that. The younger you are in America, the more likely you are to be poor. Mm. That ought to be unsettling for every one of us.
Well, Okay, let us just sit with that for a moment and bring you one more political perspective. This was Rick Santorum. This was at a Republican debate in New Hampshire in January, explaining what he sees as the recipe for avoiding poverty, essentially saying, hey, live right and you will be fine. Here's Rick Santorum.
Brookings Institute came out with a study just a couple of years ago that said if you graduate from high school and if you work, and if you're a man, if you marry, if you're a woman, if you marry before you have children, you have a 2% chance of being in poverty in America. And to be above the median income, if you do those three things, 77% chance of being above the median income.
That's all you've got to do, Tavis. Graduate from high school, work, and marry, and you'll be fine. The notion there that we've got a lot of people here who just aren't living right. And so, of course, they're in poverty.
Yep. Two things. One, there's obviously a link between education and poverty. The greater your educational level, the less the chances are that you'll end up in poverty. But even that, and we talk about this in the text, even education, though, Tom, is not the great leveler. Even education today is not the great equalizer that it once was. There are a whole lot of unemployed people with advanced degrees right now. And to your point more expressly, there are a whole lot of Americans, millions, in fact, of Americans right now who are married, with children, were once homeowners, had jobs. They were living right, if I can put that in quotes. Mm-hmm. A whole lot of people who are Christians, like Mr. Santorum, who are unemployed right now. So this notion of just living right and you ain't going to find yourself in harm's way is not accurate. People are poor, not through their own choice. Nobody wants to be poor. So many millions of Americans right now are battling poverty, trying to hold on to their dignity because of what corporate America and what our government has done to or not for them, not because they chose to be poor.
I want to get to your manifesto and what you're proposing here, but let me put that kind of Santorum perspective to you in even a more pointed way here. And this may not be what you watch all the time, but a lot of people do. This is Fox News, Bill O'Reilly. And here he was, this was just Tuesday, saying President Obama has the wrong sort of angle on how to go at economic issues and addressing poverty. And he's saying live right in even a more pointed way. The people are mooching, they're drunk, they're on drugs. Here's Bill O'Reilly.
President Obama believes that the federal government should give money to the poor, hand it right to them, in a variety of ways. Problem with that is that many of the poor will use the money irresponsibly. The high rate of alcohol and drug addiction and other social problems assure a massive amount of waste in the entitlement arena.
Cornel West, there's the Bill O'Reilly analysis. Social problems, drug addiction, alcohol, irresponsibility. You know, sinner, heal thyself.
Well, it's a beautiful thing to see Brother O'Reilly addressing the question. The very fact that he has to say something in his view that's substantive about poverty is very important because it means then we can actually see what he has to say, analyze what he has to say, and then call it into question. Radically undermine it. No, poverty goes far beyond being a character flaw and a question of bad choices. If that were the case, then a lot of investment bankers who have character flaws and made very bad choices would not have been bailed out, wouldn't have got corporate welfare, wouldn't have got the kind of socialism for the rich we associated with that bailout. That is very clear that for him, when he thinks of poor people, he thinks of substance abuse, alcoholism. No, Brother O'Reilly, it's also institutional, it's also structural. Meet some of the precious brothers and sisters of all colors in our techs who worked very hard, sacrificed very hard, lost their jobs owing no fault to their own, lost their homes and their health care, and find themselves living in tent cities, living on the streets. He's got to broaden his perspective and sharpen his analysis.
Cornel West and Tavis Smiley have written a new book, The Rich and the Rest of Us, A Poverty Manifesto. Let's go to our listeners. Paul in Peekskill, New York. Paul, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Morning, Tom.
Hi.
Turned on the radio, and you were given your introduction there about the new poor, and I was kind of stunned. I couldn't believe it. I said, I'm your sample, so I dialed up.
Tell us.
4 years, master's degree. Saved all my life. I managed to make myself save 20% of every paycheck. I've got 1 year of money left. I'm 59.
4 years what? 4 years unemployed?
Almost. A little tag in there. I had lost my health insurance, and I had complications following hip replacement surgery, and I've been in and out of the hospital three times, four mm-hmm. months last year. Mm-hmm. Certified. So I got medical bills like crazy. Had to, but I'm people look at me now and they say, you know, I'm one of those guys that they say, you know, you look 48, not 59, but they see me walking with a walking stick at an interview, and it's like, you know, it's a long day. know, and I'm going,
so 4 years without a job, 1 year of all those savings left, and do you consider yourself now poor, or are you on the edge of poverty? What do you think, Paul?
Oh, I'm going to drop off the cliff in a year. I mean, I'm living in a studio apartment. I've got, you know, my biggest expense is, you know, gasoline for my 18-year-old truck that is about to turn 200,000 miles this week. And other than that, I go to free movies courtesy of a friend on Tuesday night sometimes.
200K on the truck, and the cliff's edge is nearby. And, Paul, we wish you well. This is not an uncommon story, but I appreciate you calling in. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Let me get one more right here. Jameel is calling from Boston. Hi, Jameel. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I'm a budget counselor. I've been doing this for 5 years now, and I counsel people of all incomes. I work a lot with nonprofits, and a lot of times they help low-income people. You know, I see so many people who have houses, had flat-screen TVs, have kids. Their kids, you know, did after-school activities. They had money. They had credit cards. And they had no safety net. They have, you know, they lose a job. Something happens. And they're homeless, literally homeless. And they're saying, how can this happen to me? I've had people tell me, listen, I'm not black. This shouldn't have happened to me. I've had people say that to me. Huh. I've had people say, oh, wait, I don't live in Section 8 housing. This shouldn't happen to me. You know, I hear your announcers and I hear people asking questions. How come Obama and how come Romney and how come no one's talking about this? We're not talking about this because we think poor people are the other people. We think they live on the other side of the tracks. We think they're alcoholics and drug addicts. There are tons of rich people that are alcoholics and drug addicts. They just can afford the drugs. So if we watch O'Reilly talk about, well, you know, if we give poor people money, they're going to spend it on alcohol. You give rich people, they spend it on alcohol. We think poor people are other people, and even middle-class people don't want to admit that they can be like that tomorrow.
Jameel, you're right on it, and we hear that proximity. Let me get one more, and I'll take it to Tavis and Cornell. James in Nashville, Tennessee. James, thanks for calling. You're on.
Hi, Tom. First, I want to concur with Dr. West. Thank God for Tom Ashbrook for talking about this issue, but also thank God for Cornell West and Tavis Smiley. I want to know what you guys think about what is the best way to make the middle class, many of whom we've already established are right on the edge of going into poverty. You know, they used to say one or two paychecks away. How do you make people who don't understand, number one, what they have, and number two, how close they are to losing it, what it's like to live in poverty so that they can adjust their economic votes accordingly?
Yeah, James, let me grab it right there. Tavis Smiley, that's right in your wheelhouse. What do you say?
It's a powerful question. The ultimate answer is that the reason why we wrote this book is to try to let America see what the new face of poverty is. How close we are as a country to the edge. As I suggested earlier, no country in the history of the world, no empire in the history of the world, that is, has not at some point faltered or failed. And I don't know if it's our narcissism, our patriotism, which is now morphed into nationalism, our arrogance, our hubris, I don't know, Tom. But for whatever reason, as Americans, and we take on this notion, which is so ridiculous at this point, this notion of American exceptionalism, us patting ourselves on the back and pumping our fist and beating our chest about how great we are, given how poverty is now just engulfing so many Americans. We take this notion all in the text, but we as Americans have to understand as a nation how close we are to the edge, how on the precipice we are.
What edge? What do you mean? What do you mean?
The edge of our democracy failing. We do not hold back in this book making the argument that this, as I suggested earlier, is a matter of national security, that our democracy is threatened by poverty. You cannot continue to advance a democracy where half of your people are wrestling with poverty, where 1% control and own 42% of the wealth, where the gap between the have-gots and the have-nots continues to widen. There is dignity in all work. There is dignity in labor. When people can't use their God-given skill or talent to do something productive, their dignity is challenged, and that's a problem.
We're going to come back and look at the solutions, the manifesto that Tavis Smiley and Cornell West proposed to deal with American poverty. Their new book is The Rich and the Rest of Us, A Poverty Manifesto. We're glad you guys are there talking with us today out of New York. Listeners, you can join this conversation. What do you think? Is this you? Is it as bad as West and Smiley say? Do we have a poverty crisis? Do you privately think poverty is the fault of the poor? Bad habits, bad choices, too many handouts? How do we turn this all around? 800-423-8255 is our number. 800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about American poverty. With Cornel West and Tavis Smiley, they say it's time to do something about the rising tide of poor. Their new book is The Rich and the Rest of Us, A Poverty Manifesto. You can join us, 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. We're going to dig into it. You tell us, do you hear a solution in the Smiley-West Manifesto? How do we turn this around? Of course, it's not the first time people have talked about trying. Right up at the very top, here it is, January 8th, 1964. LBJ, Lyndon Baines Johnson, declared war on poverty.
This administration today, here and now, declares unconditional war on poverty in America. It will not be a short or easy struggle. No single weapon or strategy will suffice, but we shall not rest until that war is won.
Unconditional war on poverty in America, said the President of the United States, LBJ, in 1964. And here we are, 2012, with a whole lot of it. All right. Tavis Smiley, Cornel West, we've got people really listening to hear what you're going to propose. Let me just give you a couple of comments on there. There's lots of sympathetic comments here, but there's also skepticism. I mean, it's a long time since 1964. A lot of money, a lot of effort. Still, here's the listener who writes, "We spend more on the poor than we ever have as a nation, and still it's not enough. Have we created a class of people who choose dependency, or is this system somehow unfair in some way? Not sure, but millions of people are here illegally and find a way to make a good life for themselves with no help from the government." And here another listener, Greg, writes, "All right, give us your solutions. They'd better be something more beyond mere handouts." Solutions, Tavis.
Let me just say a quick word about solutions.
But, I mean, I think the story of our dear brother Paul is very important. We wrote this book in order to defend the dignity of all of the Pauls and the Paulings of all colors in this country.
4 years out of working on the edge of
and
losing
Paul
everything.
He's not an immigrant. Right? He's not the stereotypical face of poverty. Poverty is a moral and a spiritual issue as well as a political and economic one. There's a poverty of compassion. We have a chapter in the text on that. There's a poverty of imagination. We have a chapter in the text on that. We have never called for handouts. Johnson was not talking about handouts. The sad thing was when Johnson made that historic call for a war against poverty, that he didn't embrace quality jobs and quality employment across the board as the major means. He accented more social programs than he did full employment. He actually had members of his administration who wanted full employment, jobs with a living wage. They thought that was too radical, so they moved towards social programs. Of course, we need both. But no, we're not talking about handouts. We're talking about jobs, jobs, jobs with a living wage. Right now, we need mortgage relief for people who are losing their homes. And we need, of course, the kind of health care that builds on what Obama's talking about. I think it needs to go further in terms of ensuring that when people get sick, they have something to fall back on.
Tavis, it's hard to argue with quality jobs at a living wage, but here we are, and you and Cornel write about it a lot in the book, in a world where manufacturing has left this country like crazy. It's done that for a reason. There were much lower wages abroad. I mean, you can't just wave a wand and have quality jobs with a living wage.
The president of late has been talking about insourcing. He spent a lot of time, as you recall, Tom, in his State of the Union speech this year in January, talking about that. Prior to that speech, he had a conversation with the late Steve Jobs of Apple. We tell the story at the beginning of the last chapter about this meeting between Steve Jobs and President Barack Obama, and the president is talking to Jobs about his idea for insourcing, how he wants to roll out this idea in a major speech, et cetera, et cetera. And he asks Steve Jobs about the jobs, American jobs, that have been outsourced. And Jobs says to the president, those jobs that have been outsourced, they ain't coming back. You can talk about insourcing all you want to. Those jobs are gone, and they're not coming back.
So he's no fool. What do you do about that?
Exactly. So here's the problem. The problem is that Dr. West and I, in the writing of this book, struggle with this question, Tom. We can't come up with, maybe you and your brilliance can figure this out, but we could not figure out, putting our two heads together, a single reason, not one, why any corporate CEO is really concerned about putting Americans back to work. What they're trying to do is to cut expenditures. They're trying to cut payroll. They're trying to squeeze more profit for the shareholders. Now, once you've laid off 5, 10, 15, 25,000 people, what is the real incentive financially to bring those persons back to work if you can keep shipping those jobs abroad, making more money here at home, keep the company rolling without bringing those thousands of folk back on the payroll? What's the reason for bringing them back?
But we're a capitalist economy. That's how it works. You can't just say we want quality jobs with a living wage. You've got to come up with an economic rationale to have them here, don't you, Tavis?
Yeah, but that capitalism is all about squeezing out more profit. And once these companies, these CEOs know that they can do that, as many are doing it now, I'm just saying, and this is the bad news, I don't see the reason for these persons to be incentive. I don't know what the incentive is, rather, for them to bring these Americans back to work.
So what are you going to do? You're going to order them to bring the jobs home? How do you do that?
Oh, you need to have counter voices and counter movements.
That's right.
When Johnson declared war on poverty, it was about 21%. Within 10 years, it went down to 11%. We were still capitalists, but we had some counter voices. We had a stronger labor movement that was committed to the dignity of working people's lives, not just their checks, their lives. These are precious human beings with families like anybody else. Our labor movement now is relatively weak, but it is going to get stronger. The Occupy movement is no joke. It is very important. It's raising crucial issues that says if we have the form of capitalism in place that is so gut bucket and so vampirish, to use the language of Brother Newt Gingrich, vis-a-vis Brother Romney, then we're in deep trouble. Now, in the end, we have to talk on a global scale in terms of how you transform a narrow version of capitalism into something much more democratic. This Richard Wolff's Democracy at Work is very important in this regard. Even our dear brother Paul Krugman's book on Stop This Depression Now is very important in this regard. But what Tavis and I are calling for is a robust public conversation about this. No one of us have the bullet that somehow could, you know, generate.
Let's see if we've got wisdom from our listeners here. Buffalo, New York, Leo's calling. Leo, you're on.
Hi. I think that you're really striking on some stuff with this issue. And I really think that the history of losing the industrial sector is really the cause for our current problem. And really what we really need to do, and it's not just the cause of the new poor, the people who used to be middle-class industrial workers are no longer employed that way.
Mm-hmm.
It's also that the industrial sector employed people who were uneducated and unskilled and paid them wages that allowed them to realize the American dream of educating their children out of poverty forever and owning a home. Mm-hmm.
That worked, but now those people are doing those jobs in China.
Yes, and the trade policies put in place by Lyndon Johnson, in particular with the steel industry, which destroyed, you know, his trade decision not to put penalties on companies, on countries that were subsidizing their steel so heavily that they could dump it on our market at less than their own production cost, destroyed our steel industry and made it so that tens of thousands of unionized steel workers got put out of work.
Now, Leo, you're right on the beam that Smiley and West are on there. On the other hand, I mean, they're not charging unfair subsidies right now. They just got lower wages in a bunch of competing countries with us. Let us hold that thought and get one more. Thank you, Leo. Brenda in Aiken, South Carolina. Brenda, you're on.
Hi, Tom and guest.
Hi.
I grew up dirt poor in the Appalachian Mountains. I worked my way through Vanderbilt University and through an MBA at the University of Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
My security in the middle class should have been assured. But in the early 80s, my health tanked and I lost everything. I am not now technically poor, but I hang by a very thin thread. For these politicians, Santorum, Gingrich, Romney, to congratulate themselves and attribute their success to hard work and prudent decisions without acknowledging the role of just plain luck is ridiculous. For them to not acknowledge that they could have lost their health. They could have had their jobs outsourced.
Yep.
Their companies could have gone bankrupt and they could have. For them not to acknowledge that is either arrogant and blind or arrogant and mean-spirited.
How do we make it work then, Brenda, where we can take into account misfortune, it's going to hit some people, and be able to support people when it hits with enough jobs and everything else for everybody else so that there's, you know, a robust economy to do that? How do we do that, Brenda?
Well, you know, the war on poverty was somewhat flawed, but at least it was well-intentioned. It was an organized effort to provide a safety net. That's what was behind Social Security and Medicare, which the right wing, the Republicans, are working so hard to get rid of now, or to privatize and put the profit motive in.
Yep.
I think we have to get back to that, because the so-called Christian politicians are the worst of all, because if they were really following the teachings of Jesus, they call followed the teachings of Jesus, Jesus said, "Be ye kind one to another. Blessed are the poor."
Brenda, we got it. Yeah, and you put it powerfully. Tavis, what I hear you and Cornell saying is, in part, I mean, you've got a lot of things that in the manifesto that you want. You want universal health care, and you want quality jobs, and you want homes, and you want less incarceration, and you want food for everybody. But Tavis, at the bottom of it, we're up against some economic challenges here, and I guess what I hear you saying is you want political organization, and Cornell the same, to get people more focused on this, more rallied around it, and if they do, we will somehow, Tavis, come up with a solution?
Three things right quick. Number one, in the tradition of the black church, I want to just say amen during the last caller said. She was preaching, and I was saying amen here in the studio.
Don't wait, one. Just say it. That's good.
Yes, amen. the second thing is, Doc says this all the time. We argue this in the text. It's going to take an inside strategy and an outside strategy. We need elected officials of conscience with courage, conviction, and commitment to make poverty a priority. You absolutely need the outside forces, the voices that we're trying to raise, platforms like yours, Tom, the Occupy movement, callers like the ones who've been expressing and telling their stories today. We can't endure a campaign for the White House like we had last time between Obama and McCain, where the word poor or poverty never gets raised. We got to have that in this campaign and push this issue higher on the agenda. Finally, very quickly, we've been talking about the war on poverty, but there's also another war, or plural, wars that we've been engaged in. Dr. King said famously that war is the enemy of the poor. He was right then. He's right now. You want to solve these problems? Give me back that $1 trillion-plus dollars we've wasted in these military
excursions.
It's a lot of money. I can do something on poverty in America.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about American poverty. Let's go to Don in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Don, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I think it's rather ludicrous that so many Americans, those who are employed, are putting their savings into 401ks and 403bs that are investing in companies. We have no say in where that money really goes, that are investing in companies that are multinational, shipping those jobs across the oceans, putting people out of work. So, you know, we're putting our savings, or hoping our retirement is hinging on our neighbors losing their jobs. When, you know, there are bright people in our own communities, we could be investing in their businesses and keeping those jobs closer to home, and keeping that, because we're owning those businesses close to our home, then I think that those business owners would be much less likely to be doing harm to their home communities.
Keep it close to home, but of course it's hard to do that and get it in big corporations where they're competing internationally and making that kind of money at the same time. But I got it, Don. One more. Nancy in Somerset, Kentucky. Nancy, you're on.
I have 2 points. I think that the corporations, Ford just announced that they're building a $1 billion factory, or how many billions dollar factory in China. I think the U.S. should fine Ford, that however much it's spending on those factories, bring that money back into here.
But how are they going to sell cars in China if they don't build factories there? I mean, there's a big market growing there.
You know what? Let's get the jobs here so that people can buy cars here. And let China worry about their – I don't know. I don't know about that. I still say – okay. Second, if Walmart closes down a store and builds a bigger and better one a block away, then they should be fined for that store for as long as it's left empty, which – I'm in a small town. There's a Walmart that's been left empty for years.
Wow.
Second of all, I'm 64. I cannot get Medicare until I'm 65. I need two hip replacements. I used to be very industrious. Now I can do nothing. Part of the problem with the safety net is that it's based on inflation, and they are lying about the inflation. I dare anybody to say that inflation is not closer to 20% than to 2%.
Nancy, we got it. You're kind of stuck right there. Cornel West, let me ask you this. A lot of what you're proposing and pushing here with Tavis Smiley depends on this being raised politically. You've been very critical of President Obama for not raising these issues higher, but he looks at who votes. He knows who votes, and people, you know, with a higher incomes vote more. So who's going to raise these issues? If it hasn't been Barack Obama, if Mitt Romney says he's not concerned about the very poor, who's going to raise these issues in the center of our political arena?
It's got to be ordinary fellow citizens. When I think of the pain of my dear sister Brenda, and there's a number of Brendas, again, of all colors, and we wrote this book for them, namely to let them know we care, we're concerned. We have deep love and compassion for them, and we will ensure that their plight and their predicament is not rendered invisible, and we can't allow the politicians to be so much at the center of the discourse that they render the Brendas of America invisible, that America will not be able not just to survive, but if America does survive, it will be a mean-spirited America. It will be America that doesn't care. And the fundamental question of this book is, what kind of country do we want to be? Do we want to be cold and callous, or do we want to be compassionate and considerate to the least of these, the weak and the vulnerable, the elderly and the children and workers and people of color and our gay brothers and lesbian sisters and Jews and Arabs and Muslims? This is the legacy of Martin King we're talking about. This is the legacy of Dorothy Day.
That's a big one, and it's a big problem. Tavis, you talk about a tipping point, a cliff's edge, an edge for the democracy. Where are we in relation to that?
I think we're teetering. We're teetering, and as Doc just said, and I couldn't even come behind that. That was such a brilliant close. The bottom line is this. We're a better nation. We can do better. We have to do better. Our democracy is at stake.
Tavis Smiley and Cornel West have written a new book. It's called The Rich and the Rest of Us, A Poverty Manifesto. And they've been out looking at a lot of poverty around this country, and they've come back to tell us what they've seen and give us a little encouragement to get busy paying attention to a problem that's now right in the center of the nation's life. Tavis, thanks very much for being with us today.
Tom, thank you so much.
Brother Tom, thank you so very much. What a force for good you are, brother.
Well, always good to have you. Thank you for joining us. And listeners, thanks for your witness and your calls. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.